We're here again, Justin. We're back for the 34th episode of It's Not My Fault the OASG Podcast is Not Popular. My name is Helen.
Well, you already said my name, so I mean, do I even have to bother saying my name?
You know, it's a formality.
Yeah, you know who I am. Let's just get this over with.
Yeah, and I know who you are because we met at Otakon, finally.
Yeah, that's right. We actually did meet face-to-face. Actually, how was our first face-to-face meeting?
You skipped out on my panel.
I'm
still salty.
Yeah. So, what had happened was, you know, Otakon has their interview schedules. I was there as press. So they said, okay, you got to get there at this certain time. So I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'll go. But I actually have even worse news than that.
Well, I have a question. Do you get to request who you want to interview at Otakon?
Yes.
Or do they just kind of give you a schedule, like a class schedule?
Like, what they did was, you can request who you want to interview, but then if they'll also, like, email you times of, like, if there's a time person you want to interview and the times they're available and stuff like that. But I requested mine early, so I knew who I wanted to talk to for the most part. Anyways, back to the bad news. I actually misread the time.
Oh, no.
So, I thought I was supposed to get there at 12. I was actually supposed to get there at 12:20. Which meant that I would have just had to leave your panel while you was going on. But it's still a little bit better than just, like, saying hi, sitting down for a bit, and just walking out.
Well, that's what I thought you were going to do since you told me before the panel you had to go for interviews. And it's fine. People do leave during panels. And in case people are ever trying to do it sneakily, the presenter can see every person who leaves. Yeah. Just embrace the walk of shame.
My shame is a little bit worse because it's like, oh my god, I have somebody that writes for my site that they're actually doing a panel and I can actually watch it. And I have to go now. No. I want to stay. So, but they were like, nope, it's only Saturday. You can talk to this person. Alright. It is what it is. But anyways, how was your Otakon?
It was just so busy. They had so many events scheduled back-to-back and against each other. Like, I really wanted to make a priority of seeing the Japanese guests since I hadn't seen any panels by any of them before. But it meant I had to miss out on basically every fan panel except my own.
Yeah, I didn't, like, for me, like, first of all, it was my first time in DC, and first time at Otakon, so it's like, oh man, this is definitely a weird experience, but, like, I get to, I guess, the location itself in general, but it felt, the actual, like, stuff, like, panels being beside each other, industry panels being beside each other, being busy, feels like other conventions I've been to, so that's nothing new.
Yeah, usually I have, like, some breathing time at Otakon, but this con I was, like, having to skip out on panels just so I had a chance to go into the artist alley in the dealer's room. It's why on Saturday night when I heard it had leaked, I was really worried because I was like, oh no, what if they closed down for the rest of the con? I haven't bought anything yet!
Yeah, I didn't buy anything till, I don't think I bought anything till Sunday, I think? Or was it Sunday? I think it was Sunday. I think it was Sunday. As always, I wait to the last minute to buy stuff.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I like the con still pretty well. I do like that almost all the panel rooms are, like, right next to each other, so at least if you want to go to back-to-back panels, you don't have to run from one end of the convention center to the other. And they do have that 15-minute buffer in between panel times now for setup and stuff.
Also, the rooms are huge.
Yeah, I was in the smallest room, and I went looking up the floor plans, and even that would have been close to 200 people at full capacity, and that was the smallest.
Yeah, and just to give you an example, like, I've gone to New York City Comic Con, and generally speaking, and granted, the audiences are pretty big there too, but generally speaking, if I'm going to a Funimation panel, I know I have to get there super early, because if I don't, the lines are going to be full. Same with Crunchyroll. If I don't get there on time early enough, it's going to be full. I'm not going to be able to get in. There were still seats. I mean, it was a big room. Like, it was still people packed in there, but there were still seats available, so you could have still came in late. Which is like, what? What is this nonsense? What is this wizardry?
Yeah, when I saw the Eureka 7 movie, I got there early just to have a chance to get in line since I hadn't seen how big the room was. And once I got into the room, I was like, oh, I would have been fine just walking up time of and getting in there. I want to say I saw somebody citing a number that there were like 1,000 fans seeing there. I have no idea if it's true or not, but that room was huge, and it still had a lot of space at the end, and there were a fair number of fans there, a few hundred at least. But don't go see the new Eureka 7 movie, guys.
Wait, we'll get to that.
Bad.
We'll get to that a little bit later, like talk about what we actually did we kind of talk about what we actually did at the con. So yeah, let's start with that. Let's start with Eureka 7. How was it?
Oh my goodness. It's been so many years since the first show aired, and this is based off of Eureka 7, Psalm of the Planets, the very original 2005 series. So, like, none of the fans were quite sure what this new movie trilogy would be. And it's been a couple of years since AO aired as well, since that was 2012, I want to say, because I know it was an Olympic year. It's been quite a few years since that, and they make this new film, and starts out this really flashy new sequence, you know, there's bullets everywhere, there's laser guns everywhere, you can barely hear the music, everything looks really sleek and modern. And then they spend, like, 80% of the movie reusing footage from the 2005 series of a slightly different color palette, a different design sensibility, and it's all letterboxed.
So it's still, like, standard definition stuff.
Yeah. Oh, and I forgot to say in my review, but somebody had, like, a fetish for on-screen text on there. I think one of the folks from Reverse Thieves said it was something along the lines of what you saw in Shin Godzilla, like that amount of on-screen text just everywhere. It was so distracting, and it was just really poorly put together. Like, I didn't have super high hopes for the movie going in, since I wasn't a big fan of AO, so I thought, I don't know how this is going to work thematically, if they're going to follow the original story pretty well, they're going to try to rewrite it. This was a mess on, like, a plot and pacing level. So, like, they didn't even get to the point where this movie had themes. They're still trying to work with, this movie has a coherent story. So, that was bad. That was real bad.
So, what was at least good about it?
Nothing.
But you gave it a 2!
Because a 1 is a really bad score to receive.
So, is that like, one... so it's pity?
No, 1 would have been if they decided to completely rewrite the story to better fit in with AO.
Okay, fine.
Which would involve some explicatives I'm not allowed to say on this podcast for decency's sake.
Okay. Well, wow, yeah, that sure sounds like a great premiere, I guess. Like, I guess, how was the audience reaction? Did you notice, like, how everybody else reacted?
Oh yeah, totally, like... By the 14th flashback, I could definitely hear one section of the audience giggling, and by the 17th flashback, like, it seemed like the majority of the audience was groaning. And the director actually came on stage and said this was the first non-industry showing of the movie. I think they only finished it up on Monday and they showed it on Saturday. And he said, your reaction was very different. And I was thinking, nah, dip. And even before the movie, they'd asked, oh, who here is familiar with AO? Some cheers. The movie, you know, fewer cheers. No, they said the original series, some cheers. The movie, fewer cheers. AO, there were boos from the audience. Like,
oh, man.
Just, yeah, and that's the other thing. It's like a 2-hour movie with, like, over 20 flashbacks. My friend and I, who went with me, we started counting. I know I definitely put the numbers for that in the review if anyone wants to see, like, my exact breakdown on how bad this was. Like, all nearly 1,400 words of it.
Yipes.
I was inspired to just write how bad it was.
Well, I guess in general, I did a couple better things than you did. That would be,
God, I hope so.
Going to industry panels, boo. That's mostly because I guess, like, compared to, like, other conventions, there wasn't actually that many announcements. Compared to, like, say, Anime Expo. I think the only, like, I guess the bigger news was on Friday. I think Viz had their panel. They announced they had licensed Mr. Osamatsu, the anime that was on Crunchyroll that had the infamous first episode of parodies.
I remember I saw that first episode before they took it down.
Yeah, so they're gonna license season 1. They also licensed season 2. So I think that's actually airing this year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think it's the fall. And that's part of the reason why Otakon usually has fewer announcements. It's because we're it happens in August generally, so in the middle of the summer season, so you don't have those beginning of season announcements. So Otakon in general has fewer announcements. But I know there were some Gundam announcements, and Discotech had a ton of announcements.
Yeah, Gundam, yeah, well, the big Gundam announcement was that they're going to obviously bring an HD remaster of Gundam Seed and Seed Destiny, but they're also going to redub it from the original Ocean group dub. That's pretty rare, I think. Like, just doing redubs.
Yeah, I think so.
Like that. So, yeah, that's...
Yeah, I think they said they had to, because, like, the HD remaster has, like, some different scenes, so the lip flaps wouldn't sync up and stuff like that.
Right. Discotech, as you mentioned, they license a bunch of stuff. As you probably know their motto, they license a lot of classics, like Tomorrow's Joe, more Lupin, Cyborg 009.
Bananya.
That's the new stuff that they license, Bananya.
Bananya is modern classic, clearly.
That's more, yeah, that's getting dubbed, too, and it's going to be in Blu-ray. Yeah, dubbed by Michael to Anime News Network fame himself. It's going to be, yeah, and I listened to, yeah, they showed the dub clip, and because Bananya is short, it actually made perfect sense to make the announcement like that, and it was very good. It was very good.
It's so funny, like, the entire show, you can watch in under half an hour, so I just imagine that it probably only took them, like, 3 hours to dub it or so. I'm just imagining, like, a single afternoon was all that probably took.
Wow, yeah. I think you might have mentioned it, like, how long it took, but I can't remember. I think the only thing, like, Crunchyroll that actually piqued my interest was, Junie Tyson. They showed a video of it. It actually looked pretty slick. It actually looked pretty good. And, when I was doing more information, research into it, I didn't realize this, but Viz actually is bringing over the novel. So I'm like, oh, that's cute. Oh, it's interesting. Maybe this title will be more overlooked than I thought.
This doesn't do many novels these days.
Yeah, they announced this when they licensed, I think it was Children of the Whales, and there was another title they licensed. It was during that week. I forgot what convention they announced that in. But yeah, this was also that's when they announced Junie Tyson. So, yeah, not that many announcements. There was this about her after, like, the con, because I didn't obviously go to all the, I couldn't go to all the industry panels. Like, Aniplex had their dub announcements for some of their titles. Sekai Project actually announced some titles, or just one, just one title, The House in Fata Morgana, which makes more sense. Like, I remember, like, they licensed Gate a couple years ago.
They're doing the manga for House of Fata Morgana,
yeah, that's
right?
Since
the visual novel already has English release on Steam.
Should be more concise, I guess. Sekai Project is a visual novel publisher, but they've done, like, a few out-of-the-box stuff, like Gate, like I just mentioned, and now they're going to bring over the manga version of the visual novel of The House in Fata Morgana. And I was wondering about them, like, are they going to get back into manga and stuff like that? And I guess this makes more sense for them, I think.
I guess. I haven't been able to play the game since it's PC only. I can't do it on my Mac.
Well, I'm not a visual novel person in general. I'm just saying, like, I guess, it, like, for them, like, for what they usually publish, like, them bringing over visual novel, manga versions of visual novels, I think that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, it definitely gives them an in with an audience that's already going to be familiar with the title, at least.
Yeah. Other than that, my Otakon was talking to industry people and hanging out with the OASG members.
Yeah.
Like, for example, we talked about how we met, but I didn't tell you how I met the other OASG member, your editor of manga and sometimes light novels. That'd be Manjorin.
She stayed for my panel.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, I know.
And I'll mention she's also one of my co-hosts on the other podcast I do, Manga in Your Ears.
Yeah. It was great meeting her. It was crazy. Like, we both actually left on the same day to get to where we needed to get to Otakon, but I took the bus, she got on the plane, and Her plane got there really fast, actually, but then they had to get stuck on the one way for her, like, a good while for some reason.
Yeah, I saw her poor tweets. Like, her plane was, like, holding, I think, on the tarmac for an hour, and I think she said that even the pilot was getting annoyed about the wait.
Yeah. But she got out, and she got to the convention, and I finally met her, met her and her roommate. What was the panel we... No. I think we either met up after a panel or during a... I'm going to say it was after a panel we met up. So I'm going to stick with that. But yeah, it was fun meeting her, and we ended up... Actually, we all got together at one point on Sunday.
And I dragged you all to Chipotle.
Yes, I don't even... Helen still can't explain why she dragged us there.
Well, the good thing was, it meant I had leftovers for lunch the next day.
Meanwhile, I had that nice chorizo, which was okay. It made me wish I just got the chicken, like I was thinking. But I'm like, oh, you know what? Try something different. That's my fault. Never again, Chipotle. Never again.
I'm just so happy I introduced so many people to And Pizza here in D.C., because it's my favorite pizza chain around here.
Oh, but you didn't introduce me.
Well, no, because I had on Thursday. No, wait, no, it's my second favorite. I keep forgetting there's a Mellow Mushroom branch in D.C., but it's really far from the convention center, so I didn't go there.
You didn't tell me about this. Was that
about Ant Pizza?
No, yeah, where was that at?
It's on, I think, H Street. It's really close to the Chipotle. It's, like, right across the street from the American Art Museum, basically.
So, we ended up going to Chipotle, but you didn't decide to take us to the second best pizza place in your mind.
A, the pizza place is more expensive, and B, I just had some on Thursday night.
and that's supposed to concern me, because I did not have pizza in that week, so I could have used some good pizza. Now, whether it's better than New York pizza, I would have found out.
I've never had New York pizza, so I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I've been eating pizza here forever, so I would have judged you if it was bad. So maybe it was a good idea. Maybe it's a good thing you didn't take me there.
Okay, next time you come down for Otakon, we'll definitely go there and we'll see how you feel about it.
Okay, that'll be in the plans. Yeah. Other than that, DC was nice. The area was decent. It's basically the downtown area, so like I know like the Verizon Center was there, which. And I know because the sports teams play there.
Yeah.
Got the Smithsonian. As you mentioned. No, sorry.
Smithsonians.
Sorry, there you go.
There are 17 of them.
Okay, yeah. There you go. Yeah, pretty nice area. I did get lost at one point, though.
Only once is pretty good. It was funny because I was staying with some roommates, obviously. No one can afford those hotel prices solely by themselves. And they were really surprised that I'd started playing Pokemon Go a couple months after they had. I just didn't have a phone that could support it at launch. And they were like, how have you already caught up to us at level 29? And they open up Pokemon Go and they see how many Pokemon stops and how many Pokemon and gyms are in the same. They're like, oh, that's how. And I was like, yeah, I've got a lot of good Pokemon Go playing opportunities out here. Yes, going back to the convention, though, I think my favorite panel was anime screenwriting with Sumizawa. I didn't have a chance to look at any of the Japanese.
But that was on Friday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about going to that, but I ended up meeting with somebody for dinner, so.
And that was pretty early in the afternoon, too, so it was, like, right when you were getting in, I think. But I hadn't looked at the bios for any of the Japanese guests before I went to the panels, so I actually didn't know what he wrote mostly. He wrote some Gundam things I haven't seen.
Yeah, I think he did.
But it was funny. He was. I was listening to the Handy Gamers podcast, and as they put it, he was spicy. He was basically like, I'm not in Japan, I can say whatever I want, and just had some very funny anecdotes. Like, someone asked him at one point, oh, are there any Gundam characters you think are annoying to write, or just annoying in general? Just in general. Not any that I wrote, but in Mumble Mumble Gundam and Gundam Mumble Mumble, you know. It was a very funny panel, and he was also talking after the Gundam The Origin screening, and I really liked hearing him talk at both of those panels, and the other folks at the Gundam The Origin screening. They also had one of the producers there, whose name is slipping my mind, and then Stephanie Shea, I think that's her name?
Yeah, voice actress, yep.
Yep, normally voice actress. She does Haro in the dubs, but she's also directing the voice acting for the Gundam The Origin. She had some funny anecdotes there.
Yeah, that sounds like it would have been a fun panel to go to. What you said? This got what was the time for this again?
The screenwriting and anime panel was like Friday early afternoon, and the Gundam one was opposite the discotheque panel. Yeah, so I was just checking my phone and seeing like 30 different folks at once talking about the discotheque releases.
Okay, yeah, I think that got changed because I remember I was looking up like scheduling for Otakon, and I think we're going to get into that a little bit, like just like Otakon and DC in general. I thought that time was supposed to be at like 7 o'clock on Friday, but I guess that changed at one point.
I don't think so. I think both of those were at the same time since the beginning, since I remember looking at like the original schedule before it was on Guidebook, and the Gundam The Origin screen was definitely still on Sunday each time.
Okay, so now getting into the Guidebook, did you have any issues with the Guidebook?
It deleted my frickin' schedule like 3 times okay. in 2 days before
okay.
the con.
Okay, so I was not the only one. So I ended up talking to Manji Joran about that, and she said that that didn't happen to her when she had her Guidebook. But it happened to me a bunch of times. Like, I made my schedule, I guess, like Friday or something like that, but because they kept updating it because there were panels getting canceled and stuff like that, every time I look at my schedule, it's canceled. Like, I mean, it's all deleted. Like, what the...
Well, what happened... What happened for me was that I re-downloaded Guidebook since I don't keep it on my phone year-round, and I downloaded the update for it, and it was after the update that it kept deleting everything. So they put out, Guidebook themselves put out an update, I think, Friday evening of the con, and once I downloaded that, then it kept my schedule from being deleted over and over again. But yeah, I complained about it on Twitter, and some other folks were like, yeah, we're having the same trouble.
Yeah, I just gave up on the Guidebook by, like, Saturday. Like, at some point, what I did was I ended up coming up with my schedule. And once I was on my schedule, I just took pictures. just did pictures on my phone, and there you go. So if I did it again, I would be prepared and not have to worry about re-adding it all over again. And guess what? It deleted itself again once it did an update. And I was like, okay, doesn't matter. I already got pictures. Don't care.
I feel like at that point, you should just go ahead and use the paper schedule, Justin.
I mean...
And just highlight it out.
No, I mean, yeah, but I don't want to carry that around. I mean...
Says the guy who can actually carry a bag and wear normal clothes while walking around at a con.
We would... That's what I mean. I should get into, like... I guess we should get into, like... Otakon, getting in general. How did you think about getting into Otakon?
The bag line looked long, but each time I had to go through it, I was through in about 10 minutes, so I'm okay with that, honestly.
Okay. Yeah, like, I guess the worst time I found that was Saturday. Just to give you an example. After I left your panel to go to the Marriott where they was conducting all the interviews,
mm-hmm.
there was a line outside, and it basically stretched around the corner. When I came out, and mind you, this was probably when I was done, maybe like close to 12:50, I came back out to go back to the convention center. There was a line out still in the corner. So I was like...
You should have used that underground tunnel, Justin.
Hey. Well, yeah, if I was in the Marriott Hotel, I would have known, but I had no idea.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I end up going there, and then I'm like, wow, this line's pretty long. But then, as you mentioned, it probably did not take that long for the line to, like, get through. So yeah, bag checks were interesting. But I guess I'm used to it because, like, they do the same thing at Comic-Con. But it's just a little bit more... I feel like it's more manageable in Comic-Con. Like, they don't make... They have, like, different lines for, like, press, attendees, so you can just get through whichever way.
Justin wants his special press privileges.
Well, it's just for easy, I guess. But I get what you're saying. But, like, the bag lines were pretty... They weren't terribly long there in New York Comic-Con, and I'm glad it wasn't too long here. There was, I feel like, some people, like, that were Otakon stuff didn't really know where things were, which is understandable, because, like, they're in a new location. But I guess, like, one example was I was trying to find out where press operations was, and felt like it wasn't described enough, so, like, I didn't realize where it was until I talked to somebody that was downstairs. But that person wasn't sure either, so it's like, great.
It wasn't marked on the map?
If it was marked on the map, it was still hard to tell.
Oh, okay.
So, but eventually I did figure it out, and I wish I figured it out easier than that, so like, crap. If only I just did this, I would have gotten to the panels a little bit faster, although, like I said, as I mentioned earlier, the rooms are spacious, so like, I had no trouble getting to the panels. Just moving around was weird. Because, like, you go into, like, the hallways and stuff, and there is a mass amount of people there. But then we go into, like, something like a video game room or, like, the artist alley or the dealer's room, and it is, like, space on top of space on top of space.
It was so nice to have those wide alleys in the artist alley and the dealer's room. Made moving around a lot easier.
Yeah. I go to Comic-Con, and I'm just, like, everything is super condensed. It's going to take you, like, 10 minutes to get from point A to point B, 10, maybe longer for if you want to get to point A to point C. So just seeing that was just, like, a kind of a shock to me. It really was.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how they arrange things next year, since I feel like there's a couple of things that could have been situated a little better. Like, it was kind of weird where they put registration, since they had to move that kind of around, since everyone also had to go through a bag check. So I'll be interested to see how they did it last year, but I think where they put the dealer's room in the artist alley is where I've been predicting they'd put it for years, ever since I went to my first convention in that convention center. And I felt like the panel rooms all worked out pretty well. I mean, they were large, but they were all close together, and they had space for lineup for those rooms, so that was all really good.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I think you mentioned sorry about the artist alley having an issue, right?
Yeah, there was apparently a pretty heavy rainstorm on Saturday night. I didn't notice since I was watching Eureka 7,
yeah,
ill-advisedly.
It was raining, and, yeah, it's been raining like that. It was, like, raining really badly Friday and Saturday, yeah.
Yeah, and the building had a really odd, like, rain runoff problem, and that started leaking the artist alley. So it wasn't, like, a garbage line or any kind of pipe burst. It was just runoff rainwater, but it started coming down on stuff in the artist alley, so they had to close for a bit, move a bunch of tables around. They were planning to compensate all the artists who brought their goods to them and show them, oh, I got damaged in the rain. There was one person who slipped and hit her head, but after the EMTs checked her out, they said she was fine, so she didn't go to the ER or anything like that. But yeah, it could have gone a lot worse, and it's weird since I know other folks who've also been going to this convention center for a while, and they've said, I've never seen this problem before. So it seems like it really was more of a freak accident than anything else.
Yeah, it's more like you don't really, like, it was really pouring, so I don't know if they could have expected something like that or anything like that. They did put out
We do get heavy little monsoons in D.C., let me tell you.
Okay, yeah, as I'm finding out. Oh, I found out personally Friday, actually. They did put out an official statement, which is kind of, I was like, oh man, it must be really serious.
Well, if you think about it, that's just so misinformation doesn't get spread around as much. They can say, okay guys, here's what actually happened, we know, because we were the ones dealing with it.
Yeah, that's also because that there was reports that two artists were injured.
Yeah, I only saw about one, and I saw her statement that she put out saying, I was examined, and we decided that I didn't need to go to the emergency room, and I'm fine, so.
Yeah, so that's why I got the statement. So yeah, that was definitely something you don't really expect something like that to happen, that is for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, did you have trouble finding, I mean, you looked at the map and everything, but did you have trouble finding some of the rooms?
Not really. I've actually got a pretty good sense of direction, so usually once I go through an area, like once or twice, I can actually remember where everything's situated. And remember, I was also familiar with this convention center already.
Okay.
So once I got around to everything once, like after I was shown where panel ops was once, and I figured out how to get across to the second building, after that I was pretty good.
Yeah, kind of the
same. Although it's kind of weird getting to the panels, because like you come in through the bag check entrance, then you have to go upstairs, then you go down one flight, and then make a U-turn, and then go around.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like they could use a few more signs next year, so hopefully they do.
Yeah,
that's
my thinking too, because like, when I obviously got there, obviously, just in general, Washington, D.C. is unfamiliar to me, so just getting used to all that is enough. But then I go into the convention center, there's, like, signs with routes and numbers, and I'm like, does that matter? And then they have their signs. Autogon has their signs there, but I'm like, is this, I can't tell if this is helpful or not. Okay, panel one is this way, or is it that way, or is panel seven there? So, yeah, like, it took me a while to get to the Sentai panel, because I was trying to figure out where the heck it was. Mm-hmm. And I finally did figure it out, because it was, you have to go up to get there. You have to go down, got up the stairs and down the stairs, as you mentioned. So it's like, I think you guys didn't really have enough instructions to point that out.
Yeah, one thing I think would be useful is if they actually listed the convention center room numbers on the map. Since the convention center has a number of large signs saying, here's where rooms X, Y, and Z are, but the Otakon maps don't necessarily say which rooms those are, so I think it'd be useful if they labeled those on the maps. And part of the problem is simply that the convention center takes up, like, 3 blocks, so it covers... It has a road going in it, because that's how DC was laid out. It is so big that they just kind of had to build over the road and then keep going, bridge-style.
Yeah. Other than that, I don't think I have a problem with where they put everything. I think they put everything pretty well. I think the only maybe contention is maybe they can put the video game room downstairs, but that's just me being like, eh, I don't really care that much about games.
Justin, if you're about to sit down and game for a while, we're going to make you spend some energy to get up there in the first place. Oh my god, I was looking at the health app on my iPhone, which automatically logs how far you've walked, and I walked to, like, almost 7 miles on both Friday and Saturday, so... So yeah, so that was my Otakon. It went pretty well. The worst thing was when I came back from the con and discovered that the air conditioning unit in my condo had started flooding a little bit, so yeah.
Yeah. I guess, like, just for press, like, everything was fine. I guess, like, the only thing is they should probably, like, I don't know if you felt it, but it felt like this year's Otakon was definitely late on certain things, were they?
Otakon's always like that, announcing, yes, getting the schedule out. They always tend to just be a little later than I'd prefer on that.
Okay.
Thankfully, they do let panelists know, like, around early June when panels are accepted or not. So usually it gets to the point where it's like mid-May, I'm like, if I don't hear from them in 2 weeks, I'm assuming my panel got accepted and I need to work on it now.
Okay. Yeah, okay, but for press, like, I guess it was fine. But I guess for industry, it needs a little bit better. Because I was talking to a couple people that were working in the industry. Because they got some stuff late, like, they couldn't really, like, maybe, like, usually for they go to a convention, they get, like, okay, we can have this much stuff there, like, 2 months in advance, something like that. But they got notification, like, maybe 3 weeks in advance. So so it was, like, kind of, like, unprepared for certain stuff. So it was very, like, Otakon took their time, which was, like, not very helpful for them. Other than that, like, I feel like Otakon in D.C. was good. I don't know how much better it was compared to Baltimore, though.
Yeah, the industry and, like, Artist Alley dealers notifications, that's not something I've experienced with, so I can't really comment on it. I will note it was nice that we didn't really have any big traffic hang-ups in this convention center, since, oh my god, the ones in Baltimore could get really frustrating at times. So we did avoid that here, which is, I think, one of the biggest things. That Skybridge in Baltimore, man, you don't understand. It was narrow, everyone had to go through it, and it was basically unair-conditioned. It was bad.
Oh boy, sounds bad.
Yeah. Okay, so I think that's enough about Otakon. You think so?
It was great actually meeting you in person.
Yeah, it was good to see you. You are just as tall as I expected.
You're still as normal as I expected.
You think I'm normal? Oh god, off-brand.
Speaking of off-brand, that picture you took was very off-brand.
Of the three of us? I think it was a good photo.
Good photo, but like... We're antisocial geniuses. We're not supposed to be, like, all public and everything.
Says the man who is using it currently as a Skype icon.
Anyways, let's move on to news that actually took place in the past... Wow, we haven't recorded a podcast in forever, so there was some news that we're going to try to run down quickly, if we can.
In news that everybody expected, Daisuke is shutting down.
Did you expect that?
Yeah, they haven't really gotten any exclusive licenses in a while. They've never done much in terms of social media or outreach. They just never quite seem to figure out how to do the online streaming thing, so I'm not terribly surprised by that.
So are they like... So were they just like J-Manga?
Yeah, I was just thinking like J-Manga, yeah. Except J-Manga actually had a lot of like exclusives on their website, which was great. Daisuke didn't even have that.
They had a But
I'm really frustrated they took Turn A Gundam down before I could finish it.
Yeah, I think they had a few exclusives, but I guess not like the big exclusives that get them to come to their site. And it's more disappointing the fact that, like, weren't this backed by a bunch of, like, studios and stuff in Japan?
Yeah, studios who still have no idea how to market to the international audience and should leave that towards folks they hire who have specific experience doing it.
Yeah, that might be it, too. So yeah, it sucks with Daisuke. And just to be clear, they're shutting down October 31st, and then I guess they're gonna keep going until whenever Dragon Ball Super finishes. I don't know when that's gonna end, but like that's gonna be the only title they're gonna have on their site, Dragon Ball Super.
Man, that could go on for years too.
Yeah. So you have no idea how that's gonna be. Sony Pictures is actually, they have a stake in Funimation now.
Funimation, they keep getting bought, and then sold back, and then bought again, and sold back.
Yeah, like how many, like, I'm trying to think, like, I feel like they was bought by somebody recent, too. I can't remember.
Shoot, I am blanking on who it was, but yeah, they were definitely bought and then sold back again within the past 5 years.
Yeah. So yeah, Sony paid out a bunch of money for this. like 140 million, I think?
It was a lot. I just hope Sony's willing to put that much money in there. They might have enough money to go after, like, the Evangelion license or Challenge Harmony Gold from Across. I just hope that with that much money to throw around, that they might pick up some stuff I want.
I wonder if this just means that they're going to put through, like, their live-action stuff through there.
Or heck, maybe we'll even get Nodame Cantabile, since that one's always had a really weird licensing situation, since the first season is owned by Sony itself, so...
Yeah.
That'd be weird.
I wonder how this is going to affect, like, the relationship between Crunchyroll and Funimation.
They'll probably still compete on some titles and work together on others.
Yeah, like, Justin Savakis, pretty much, he knows his stuff in the anime industry. He's basically thinking that this is probably not going to work out. Like, maybe this year will be fine, but probably long term, this relationship isn't going to last, because Sony's going to want to do their thing, especially since they actually have a streaming service.
Crackle?
Yes, remember that?
Yeah, that's where I've seen the Nodami Cantabile dub. Also, explanatory comma, Justin Savakis, he does the Answer Man column on AnimeNewsNetwork.cc.
Right, right.
Oh, man. Did Anime News Network get hacked in the time that we had between our podcasts?
They did. They did.
Oh, yeah. So that happened.
That happened before Otakon, actually.
Oh, I remember, because someone was posting on Twitter, hey, you know, a lot of stuff's backed up on the Internet Archives in case anyone needs to do last-minute panel research.
The crazy thing is, I was having a productive day. I was just, like, I was doing some sort of work that was, like, yes, avoided the Internet for most of the day, mostly avoided Twitter. Let's go see what's happening. And I come back, and I'm like, okay, the anime Twitter account's been hacked. You can't go into the website anymore. What in the name of... What is going on?
And they did actually put out a big explanation for, here's how exactly it happened. So no one's password or accounts on the site were compromised, which is good, since a lot of people were worried that their forum handles and stuff could have been compromised, but nothing was touched there. The encyclopedia is still fine, so
yeah,
that's all good.
And then I spoke, and I think they mentioned it before, too, and I saw Zach at Otakon, and he mentioned that yeah, they're going to get the website back, the actual .com back at some point. When, who knows, but they will get it back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only frustrating thing is that it means, like, all the links on Wikipedia and stuff to Anime News Network are currently broken, since they all direct to the .com, not the current .cc.
Yeah, like, yeah, it's going to be, yeah. Well, eventually that will get fixed, eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, didn't mention this earlier, but this is also announced at Otakon. Aria the Animation is getting kickstarted for an English dub. That dub's been funded already.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, since I remember a couple of years ago when Funimation did their Kickstarter for the Escaflowne dub, it was like, oh, why would you fund this? Do a Kickstarter, you know it's going to get a lot of support. But for Aria, I was genuinely wondering if they would have enough support to get a dub. And it already has, easily, so it's like, okay.
Yeah, well, like,
great for them. But that's definitely more of a niche title. I could see them being genuinely unsure if there would be enough demand to support the cost of making it.
Well, I think, yeah, I see what you're talking about. I think the interesting, I think the interesting thing for this is that, like, yeah, it's been funded already and stuff like that, but, like, what could they possibly add for more rewards and stuff?
I think some people probably funded it, since they're also using it as a way to get funds to do the Blu-ray releases, I think. And I can see why people would want to see that shell and Blu-ray Blu-ray release. I'm not a fan of it, but it does look pretty.
I actually have the DVD of it. I haven't watched it yet. Like, I bought that, like, I think I brought this to, like, Kinokuniya, and I was like, was it cheap? I think it was kind of cheap. So I said, okay, let me get it.
It's very much an Yashike show.
Yeah. We're going to talk a lot about Netflix.
Well, Netflix is a major player in the anime game somehow now.
So. Yeah. I guess we could start with the kind of good news. All the episodes of Little Witch Academia are up on their site. So if you were just waiting to get all that, you can binge it now. Just do it. Do it. I guess in lesser news, although I'm looking forward to it. The Death Note, by the time this podcast goes up, the Death Note live action film will be up on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the one they premiered at San Diego Comic-Con, so Justin, will we see a review from you on it? Since it's just a movie, right? It's not a full TV series.
There is a potential... What's that?
It's just a movie, right? Yeah, not a full TV movie. Series, yeah, so it's easier to watch.
Yeah, it's a movie, so... I guess I'm gonna have to, because I've basically seen... Except for the novel, I've basically been immersed in all Death Note stuff, so... I wouldn't say counter it, but I will probably look to do that.
Yeah, since I know that I'm not a fan of Death Note, so you won't be getting that review out of me, so.
And I guess this is the one where I remember when this was announced, I literally just replied to a comment, like, without knowing why, and then I found out why this person was so angry or something like that. Like, oh, this is why. So, yeah, Netflix, they're announcing that, I think Violet Evergarden is a KyoAni show, right?
Yeah, it's based off of, like, the only Grand Prize winner Kyoto Animation has had for their Create a Story We Might Animate It contest.
Yeah.
And that's something else that premiered at Anime Expo. They already had the first episode finished, even though it's not airing in Japan till next winter. They've got a ridiculous lead time on that first episode.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But now... but now it's a little bit different because Netflix now has it, and that, who knows what that means? Because I guess, like, who it's supposed to air in the winter, but maybe in Japan it's going to air in the winter. Who knows if it's going to air over here?
Yeah, our best guess is probably spring, so probably not till next April, which has a lot of, it has inspired a lot of gnashing of teeth on Twitter.
Would it be hilarious if it actually aired in the summer?
Oh, I think hilarious is the wrong adjective here.
No, mostly because of the fact that, like, Kakaguri, which is airing now, is not going to air until the winter.
Oh, did they say winter for that? I
forgot. Oh, well, okay. Yeah. I'm guessing it's winter, but I do have 2018.
No, I think you're right, yeah.
I do have 2018. Okay. But yeah, like, it's airing now, but it's going to air next year. Like, what?
I just think it's so funny for Kakaguri. I know, like, there's so many people on my timeline who want to see it, and I magically have a review copy of it from Yen Press that I don't even remember requesting.
Oh, yeah.
So it was
there you go. I'm still waiting for that review, by the way. Anyways.
It's like, I've almost gotten to reading it. I almost got through my entire to-read list, Justin, and then I got your more manga today, so.
Better not put that on the back burner, even if you have Delicious in Dungeon.
Well, I mean, Delicious in Dungeon I'd prefer to read before Kakiguri, but I got Kakiguri first, so I'll read that first.
Thank you. Netflix, they're a weird, like, player in the industry. I'm just going to say that right now.
It's also kind of hard to figure out why they license the anime that they do, since some of it seems more niche, some of it seems to have more mainstream appeal. I haven't figured out what exactly their goal is for what series they pick up yet.
Well, at least they have something. At least I can figure out what they're doing aside from Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon is even more inscrutable.
Like, I don't even... You know what's hilarious? I'm going to tell you a good story.
Good.
So I did talk... Like I said, I talked to people in the industry, especially at Otakon, because that's where you're seeing most of them.
I think you told me the story at Otakon.
Yes, and now I'll tell it to everybody else. So I'm talking to somebody that works in the industry and had no idea Anime Strike existed until I told them. Me going like, wait, you can't be serious. What does that mean? And you know what the worst part is? This person says she's a Amazon Prime member. So I'm like, you're an Amazon Prime member, but you don't know about the service. And it is what this lines up with somebody that I was talking to on Twitter, where if they weren't on Twitter following anime people or people that like report or say anything about this stuff, they wouldn't know that Anime Strike exists because they don't send it. They don't Amazon doesn't mention it in their newsletters or anything like that. So I'm like, okay, if the person in the industry doesn't know about Anime Strike, how are you advertising your service?
Yeah, and I've seen some people looking at the Amazon Strike Twitter account saying, look, they don't tweet that often for a social media account. Whenever they do tweet, they're basically parroting what Sentai is saying about the exact same
thing. Yeah, show. I actually so, was...
If they are run by the same social media person, it would make some sense, but I can't imagine that being
They're definitely not. I actually was keeping tabs on that myself, because I noticed that, like, they treated, like, they had their last retreat of a Sentai thing, if I'm not mistaken. Or was it Aniplex? Okay, I don't remember. But it was, like, July 31st when it was the last, like, tweet in general, and then I'm like, okay, it's like August 10th, and they haven't said anything. What is going on here? I have no idea if they're getting, like, antsy, or they're just, like, don't respond to anything at this point, because I know they're getting questions from people, and they're getting questions from me too, so
you remember when Lauren Orsini wrote that article for Forbes, they actually asked her if she could try to write the interview in such a way that it wouldn't reveal how many questions they didn't answer, because I remember she tweeted, like, this is the equivalent of burning bridges. Somehow it doesn't seem to have burned the bridge, thankfully.
Well, who knows, like, she may not even be getting responses, like, that often. Like, if she's sending questions or anything like that, she may not be getting, like, responses back. Who knows Amazon? But at least for Netflix, like, even with their problems, like, they should, like, if they, like, my opinion is, if they're gonna get into anime, they should be actually bringing this out closer to, like Crunchyroll does it, or, like, Funimation does it. They should be doing that. I guess what they're doing, like, they're trying to do original stuff, like bringing, like, Cannon Busters, Be the Beginning, stuff like that. I guess that's gonna...
Yeah, since I think it was also during our break that Netflix announced that they were co-producing, like, 6 or 8 original anime, including Cannon Busters, including Be the Beginning and Aiko by Bones, and, like, a couple of others as well.
Yeah, New Baki the Grappler, Sword Guide, Saint Seiya, Lost Song, those are the titles. They're basically gonna back those titles, and I guess it means 2018 is gonna be a big year for Netflix regarding anime, for sure.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so the anime industry, Justin and I are still confused by a lot of it.
Definitely confused by Netflix, and more confused by Amazon. And then the last announcement I kind of want to mention is Cross Infinite World. Shoujo and Josei Light Novel and Manga Publisher, they made an announcement during Otakon Day. the first day of Otakon, they made the announcement that they licensed Obsessions of an Otome Gamer. It actually sounds like an isekai story, except...
It does.
Except you have the girl just transport into an otome game.
Part of the reason it sounds like isekai, I think, is because their name is actually Cross Infinite World. So.
Right, but then also because the main character dies, but then is reincarnated into an otome game.
You know, that's probably one of the better reincarnations you could get out of an isekai story, honestly.
Okay. So yeah, this is coming out next year, or. Yeah, I believe it's coming out next year, early 2018. It's going to be digital, so it'll be interesting how that title would do, for sure.
Yeah, as a side note, I really wish I'd had a chance to read, like, some of their series before I did my shoujo panel, because I did mention them briefly, but I would have liked a chance to actually bring them up more, since I saw one or two folks tweeting, oh, these titles seem pretty well-known that she's talking about, I wish she would talk about more obscure stuff, and I bet if I could have, like, talked about some of that stuff, I bet that would have been really obscure. Like, actual shoujo-licensed light novels.
Right. So, yeah, I think that's a bit it for news.
Yeah, and in news, I'll make Justin very happy. Justin, we're finally going to talk about Endless Corner of the World.
I don't believe it. We're actually going to do it. We actually should, like, set up the story, because I think the last time we talked, you said you were thinking about seeing it at Otakon. what happened?
I was, but there was so much going on that I just had to back out of it. And I went to a little bit of the panel afterwards talking about it. I had to back out of that as well. And now, having seen it in theater, I really regret not having been able to see it at Otakon with those comments from Maruyama and other staff worked in there. I really wish I'd been able to see it, but there was too much going on at Otakon, Justin. There was too much. All right.
So now that we got the backstory for that, yes, we're going to finally talk about one of the more interesting titles that's coming out in America and in the U.S. In this corner of the world. It's basically set in like the before World War, like I guess yeah, after World War One and then into World War Two, and then
definitely after, since remember yeah. World War One ended in like 1919.
Right.
So.
Okay. Right. But I guess like the after effects of World War One, and then I think even like at the start. If I'm not mistaken, it kind of briefly... No, not actually, not really. Basically, this movie is like Hiroshima, before World War II, and then after World War II.
Yeah, the story starts around 1933, where we have some glimpses of our main character, Susano Urano's childhood, living in what modern day is definitely, I think, part of Hiroshima City, but I think was still on the outskirts at the time.
Yeah.
So starting in the 1930s and going up until she's around 18 or so and marries into the Hojo family, which happens around, I think, 1942, 1943. So definitely getting into the war there. But yeah, it starts during Japan's imperialistic period.
Yeah. Honestly, like, the first half of it was beautiful.
Yeah, I've seen your review of it. I do have some disagreements for your review, but yeah, the first half was really nice, both story-wise and visually.
And comedy-wise. I literally mm-hmm. I was dying in the theaters. It was
which is a weird movie to say.
Yeah, no, it really is.
Weird thing
yeah.
to say about a movie
yeah.
that involves
that's what I
the bombing of Hiroshima.
That's what made it more interesting because, like, you've seen *Grave of the Fireflies*, and for me, like,
actually, I haven't.
Oh, really?
I don't want to cry that
oh,
much,
wow.
Justin.
That's news to me. But okay, but for I guess for me, like, I've seen *Grave of the Fireflies*, *Barefoot Again*.
Haven't
so obviously, side stories. Like, then there will be obviously some lighter moments, but for the most part, it's going to be about tragedy of the war. But for In This Corner of the World, it takes a different approach. It basically goes through one perspective, that perspective of Suzu, who's kind of an airhead. And she's kind of... And the way they animate the faces of the characters, how she reacts to everything, I feel like it was timed really well, and it made it just, like, hilarious for, like, almost every single thing.
Yeah, and part of the story is that Susano is a daydreamer, and she's also an artist, a pretty skilled artist, it looks like. So a lot of scenes in the show, not the show, the movie, show it as if she had drawn them, and so it has this very nice look to it in a lot of cases. Not quite like watercolors, more like pastels, if she was using chalk pastels or colored pencils. So it's a really beautiful movie to look at. And it's funny, since when I saw the stills for the movie and the poster, I didn't think I would like the art style that much.
Yeah, same here.
Seeing it in motion,
same
it works
here, yeah.
really nicely. And it looks very much like the manga's art style as well, from the little bits I've seen of the manga.
Yeah.
Good color palettes,
yes,
too.
Yes, very good.
Lots
yeah.
of good color palettes.
So yeah, and I guess we could say we should probably point out this is a spoiler cast, so we're going to be letting it... We're going to basically talk about every aspect of the film.
I mean, I'd make a joke about spoilers, World War II happens, but we actually mean, like, actual spoilers
yeah,
for the movie,
yeah.
like, the contents of the movie.
Obviously, in the second half, Suzu's, like, personality begins to change because the war happens. And
okay, let's just say spoilers are going to start now, guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely a different tone, for sure. And that was one of my concerns. How would, like, it's very, like, it's definitely leaning toward the comedy, but how would it manage the fact that, yes, the war is going to happen, and that means things are going to change? And I don't know if it handled it as well as it should have.
Yeah, I saw your comments on that in your review that's been up on the site for a little while, since you saw this movie before me. Did you feel like the comedy felt out of place once things started getting more serious?
It's more
or
like,
what did you feel?
Okay, so now I can spoil it. So you know the part where she's a daydreamer, and even at like the start of the film, like they show her potentially daydreaming that she was abducted by, like, I guess some carriager or something like that, and she was with that boy. So they established that, but then okay, we can see that the war is happening, and then there was a really serious moment where. Either I can't remember if it was obviously somebody close to them and the child I can't remember her
name. Hiromi, I think. Okay. I think that was the girl's name.
Yeah. So, yeah, the airplanes are coming.
But Susanoo's niece.
Yeah, okay, right. It's definitely been a while. So, yeah, the planes are coming. They're basically shooting the town. And then we find out, oh, it was actually all her a daydream. For some reason, that took me out of the film.
No, I mean, some of those were daydreams, but some of those definitely weren't, since there's a whole sequence where they have to keep getting up in the middle of the night for air raids,
and it starts getting a little more comedic
as they just put in less and less effort every time. They're just like, actually, I was kind of wondering why they didn't just start sleeping in the bomb shelters at that point, since that's what people in England were doing during the Blitz.
Right, but no, I understand that. But the when it happened during the film, and I don't know if it's just because I know, like, the war is pretty tragic and stuff like that, and what it's done to people and so and everything, but, like, I don't know, it felt like that daydream where after, oh, it was a daydream, everybody was laughing. I don't know, it felt wrong at that moment in time. Like, I'm thinking, like, I don't know if that was needed. I guess you feel differently?
I've got two thoughts on it. One is that I've read an interesting memoir from the other side of the war. It's called The Last War. It was part of this huge project in England where slightly before the war began, people realized it was going to happen, so they had hundreds of people start journaling their day-to-day lives to record kind of how this was going to affect society. And Nella Last was one of the best people from the journaling. She wrote this really interesting writings on living through the war, and they've published them since then. And so you see someone who is going through the entire Second World War, living both a very ordinary life and also a life under war. And just because you're in war, you don't change your personality. You don't change how you live some parts of your day-to-day life. And also, to get really real here, I was talking to my mom after Otakon. She asked, so did it feel kind of weird that you guys were, you know, having a good time while Charlottesville was happening? Yeah. And it was like, and I was saying, well, hey, we've already been making all those jokes for quite a while that we just need some escapism. And also because you can't stop living your life just because of one bad event, which sounds rather harsh, but it's also self-coping. You can't be continuously focused on the tragedy, or, like, you literally stress yourself out and your body just starts doing really bad
stuff
to
you. I'm going to add to that. I saw this at the Japan Society, and after that panel, they had a Q&A with Taro Maki, and somebody asked a question.
Remind me,
The producer of the film. And I think there was a question that's something involving around that, and he was mentioning that stuff like the earthquake and 9/11. Like, yes, they were happening and tragic, but we still have to keep going. Like, these events happen, we have to keep going. So it's like, yeah, I get that. That is understandable.
Yeah, so for me, those parts didn't feel incongruous to the film as a whole. I felt like it's very much some people trying to regain their claim over their own lives through controlling what they can. Like at the scenes where Susanoo's mother-in-law and sister-in-law are trying so hard not to laugh as some folks are accusing Susanoo of espionage, which is a really serious crime, but the two of them are thinking to themselves, she's such an airhead, there's absolutely no way she could be a spy, and we can't tell these secret police that because, you know, this would just end badly. And so that's kind of what it reminded me of, just reclaiming your life in the small ways you can.
Yeah,
for me, the one issue I took with the film was one that you did actually mention. It's that Susanoo seems to feel very strongly about the surrender of Japan at the end of World War II. That part did feel a little out of place to me, but that's because I'm aware of the history. And the thing is that Japan just did a lot of really bad stuff leading up to World War II and during World War II. And their family, in some ways, felt very unconnected to the war. Like, they were living through the war, but they didn't seem to have that personal, imperialistic, you know, spiritual stake in it. So to see Susanoo get so upset over losing the war just hit me a little oddly. Well,
I think they had their brother. If I'm not mistaken, he joined the war. He was
drafted. Susanoo does actually lose her entire family in the war, essentially.
And then she lost her brother during, like, I guess the fighting. And then the bomb hit Hiroshima, and then eventually the mom and dad died.
The mom was killed during the bombing. Yeah. The father died of radiation poisoning probably soon after. And it looks like her sister is dying of it in the final bits of the film.
Yeah. So yeah, that happens. So, I mean, I can see why, but I don't think the film, like, really emphasizes, as you mentioned, the film doesn't feel like it emphasizes that enough.
Yeah, and I think I saw someone else who wrote a review who said that even in Japan, that scene has been criticized a little bit. Since in Japan, they do try to more strongly condemn the war these days, just, I think, kind of like the way Germany tries to strongly condemn their connection to World War II these days. So that was the one part that felt kind of odd to me, that she seemed to have a connection in there that hadn't been implicated.
And then
just suggested earlier in the film, sorry.
And then to add to that, how did you feel like how it portrayed Japan? Yeah, as you mentioned, Japan. And then how did you feel in general the film portrayed Japan?
One thing I like to do is I like to think of a government's actions being separate from their citizens' actions.
Right.
So I didn't have as much problem seeing individuals humanized during the course of this film, especially since they were concerned about such small things about, like, the personal safety of their friends and family and stuff like that. So I was able to separate that from the horrible brutality of Japanese imperialism, which has helped give rise to the modern crapple that is China. Like, I was able to separate those two.
Yeah, there was somebody that actually asked the question wondering why they decided, at the Japan Society, somebody who questioned why they actually decided to go to this route where they didn't really show that Japan was also in the wrong as well. But then the producer explained that this is from one person's perspective. This is literally Suzu's perspective. We're not looking at it from any other way. We got the, like, obviously you know the history behind Japan's side of it, but this is from how Suzu views. We're in Suzu's world. We're going to view for her. And I got that. I just feel like, and personally, I think it's actually kind of refreshing because you find, in watching all these other World War films, you see, like, it has this, it kind of either goes to the middle or it goes to, yes, Japan was also wrong. So I kind of found that refreshing for this film. I do feel like at some point, maybe, like, towards the end, that they could have, like, emphasized that, okay, maybe Japan maybe Japan was also in the wrong. So yeah, that was, I guess, my thing with that too.
Like, my own personal thoughts on history is that Japan did an awful lot of shitty things during World War II. We being Americans, also did some shitty things World War II. Like, I have seen actual footage from the planes, because folks probably don't know, but during World War II, they fitted video cameras onto literally every single warplane, so I've seen actual footage of them doing dive bombing runs over Japan and shooting up, like, train stations and stuff like that. We also did some really shitty things as well, but I can watch this movie without being too concerned about that, because it is the story of a fictitious individual here.
Yes. Like, they did their research to make sure that, obviously, this reflects experiences that happened during the war. But this is obviously a fictional war. Except for the history, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one reason I wish I'd been able to go to the showing and the panel afterwards at Otakon and stay the full time was because they started talking about a lot of the research they did into it, which was fascinating. Like, they said that, I think it's the market that Susanoo goes to in the first couple minutes of the film in Hiroshima, a Japanese viewer would have instantly recognized it as that is the site of the Peace Memorial these days. But viewers from outside of Japan probably wouldn't know that, since they probably just haven't seen pictures of Hiroshima. And I know at the bits of the panel I went to, they said they wanted to do this movie now because this is when we still had some survivors alive, but if they start making it much later, then you really risk losing that first-hand eyewitness account of this life before the war, which isn't as well documented anymore since so much was destroyed in the nuclear bombings and the other bombings as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So what did you think of the second half of the film?
Like I've been saying, I think people can probably pick up on it, but I was okay with it. I felt like there was less comedy there, but that's fine, and I never felt like the comedy was too much. It felt very human in a way, like how they got progressively more and more tired during the air raid attacks and were just doing less and less, just sort of rolling out of bed and going to the air raid shelter. I mean, my only thought from that scene was, why didn't you guys just start sleeping in the air raid shelters at that rate,
right,
if you're so worried about it? I was okay with it getting more serious, since that's when the war was truly starting to ramp up, and the U.S. was closing off more supply lines for Japan, they were attacking them more. So I felt like the movie felt like a cohesive whole there. I didn't feel like it was thematically dissonant between the earlier half and the later half.
Honestly, like I said, like I mentioned earlier, the daydream, that one daydream, it kind of just threw me off. Like, obviously, the moments that happened during the second half, especially what happened to Suzu, like, she was with the child that unfortunately passed. Like, what? You said it was Hiromu, right? The sister-in-law's daughter.
Hiromi?
Yeah, remember?
Yeah, she definitely died. What were you thinking?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. She, for Suzu, like, her losses, like, she was with Hiromu when she died, and then she also lost her drawing arm. She was really mm-hmm. good as a draw. We didn't. I forgot. We didn't emphasize this enough. I'll take a little bit of blame of that because we went straight to.
Oh no! I said that she's a really good artist.
Yeah, she's a really good artist. But yeah, and it like there was this one point where she was like she drew somebody else's artwork for him, and it was so good. He was like, I can't turn it. What? I can't turn this. This is all wrong.
And then he says, I did turn it in. The teacher tried to put it in an art competition. And I was like, oh no, I'm not actually the artist.
Yeah. So yeah.
Actually, the story reminded me a little bit of real life. Shigure Mizuki, the mangaka, who did stuff like Gege Kitaro. He actually lost his dominant drawing arm during the war as a soldier and had to relearn how to draw with his other arm after it.
Yeah.
That's what it reminded me of.
Yeah, if you read like the Showa manga, you'll get a sense of where he was at. You get a sense of where he was at there.
Yeah, if you feel like this movie didn't portray war as hell enough, go read his.
Yeah.
He's very much like, war is hell. Yeah. I have been through this hell.
Yeah.
Let me give you all the sad details about it.
Yeah. But yeah, like, the stuff that's happened to Suzu, yes, that definitely got to me, but anytime I tried to do any comedy at that point, I was just like, I couldn't really enjoy it. Like, I couldn't really laugh at it. I don't know, like, I didn't think that. Like, I kept thinking if that daydream didn't happen at that point in the film, would I have minded the comedy? And my thinking is, I probably wouldn't have.
Do you mean the sequence where it was kind of artistic, showing how she's drifting in and out of consciousness? Afterwards,
like I said, the moment where she's with Hiromu and Hiromi in the fields, and they were talking, and then that got the soul. I'm not sure if it was the uncle or the dad, they were in the fields, and then all of a sudden the U.S. planes came in and they were shooting in the area. They had to duck. One of the rocks, if I'm not mistaken, hit the uncle. It happened during the middle of the film, and then after that they had Suzu woke up or something like that, and then they all thinking, oh, she's changing again, and everybody's laughing.
No, I don't remember that scene. I mean, I remember a scene where Susanoo and Hiromi were trying to avoid the shrapnel, and her father-in-law protects them.
That one.
What I remember is that he gets hit by the shrapnel, but he falls asleep in the bombings that are laughing at him, because Susanoo has been panicking, thinking he's dead, but no, he just somehow fell asleep, and he's actually okay.
But that, as far as I know, was established as Suzu kind of daydreaming.
No, I don't think so. I don't think that sequence. Maybe I'm just not
that
remembering
be
the sequence
it.
You're thinking of.
That should
of.
Be it. You're on the right track. But that was that scene that kind of took me out of the film.
Clearly, I need to just buy this movie and see it again. I was already planning on doing that, so. I did really enjoy this film. Like, between this and Your Name, like, those two alone have been really good anime films this year. And I'm also going to see The Napping Princess.
Yeah.
In a month, which I know you also like. So this is just a really good year.
Yeah, for I was thinking, films. Yeah. Even with this type of misgivings, I think this is actually a film you should watch, because it's still pretty funny, it's still pretty good, and yeah, I was thinking about this too. Like, we had Napping Princess, we had Your Name in this corner of the world. This has been a very strong year for films, for anime
films.
Or just
going to ignore Eureka 7.
Well, I mean, that hasn't really...
I'm going to keep on dunking on that movie. I'm just going to keep on dunking on
that
it.
That hasn't really aired outside of Otakon, so I'm not even...
Yeah.
And I think they added new locations for... Oh, no, there's going to be... I think there's a New York location and an L.A. location for The Napping Princess, and they're going to open it up to a national audience for that soon.
Yeah, since I think the national release date is September 8th, since I've got tickets for September 9th on a Saturday.
Okay.
But yeah, going back to In This Corner of the World, it is a mature story about war, but not in the sense that it's really bloody, and you probably don't want to show this to young children, but, like, once you hit teenager age, I think it would be appropriate to show that to younger kids, and then start having serious talks about, here is war, and here is how even people in enemy countries live, you know? This is to remind you that they are still human, despite what is going on, and how you handle all that, and how you interact with that.
Oh, yeah, you reminded me about that. What did you think of the actual overall violence and stuff like that in this film?
I thought it was appropriate, but like I said, I've accidentally seen some very gruesome things from real wars, including this war.
What did you think of the ending of the film?
I thought it was a little overly saccharine that they find an orphan or an orphan finds them and seems to be a perfect fit, but I was okay with it. I was okay with the idea of they will go on, they will continue to live lives beyond this war, and they will find hope in small ways. I was okay with that being the tone of the film. I was just going, that is one of the least realistic parts of the story.
Yeah. But yeah, that it was definitely an interesting film. As you mentioned, I wrote a review of it because I saw it at Japan Society. Go read that, and then there's going to be more. I imagine there's going to be more screenings at some point of this film. You should still go see it. And you'll probably feel differently than me. So there you go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a really good movie all around. And it was so funny. At the showing I was at, I bought a sub ticket, but they started playing the dub. And I was in a showing of, like, only 20 people, but immediately, like, 4 people jumped up and ran to the ticket counter and told them, you need to restart this film, you need to do in the sub. Which I was so glad, since I was just hearing the dub voices, and I was like, give me the sub.
Yeah, I didn't have to worry about that for my showing. Ah!
Yeah, the Japanese American Society, I can't imagine them showing the dub instead.
Yeah.
Japan Society, that's it, sorry. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any other potential thoughts on this film?
I think I mostly thought out, it's a good-looking film. I definitely want to buy it so I can look at it again. And I'm now actually interested in the original manga, which Seven Seas is going to be putting out, I think probably starting early next year, probably early 2018.
I think it's actually going to come this year.
Okay, never mind. Later 2017 then. Oh, you're right. I think I saw an October date for it. Yeah, so I'm definitely interested in seeing it now. Like I think we've alluded to, this isn't an autobio manga. This is fictional, created by someone in modern-day Japan, but I'm still going to be interested in seeing the manga, see if anything was changed, and just experiencing the story again.
All right. I have no further thoughts aside from go watch it. I think I personally like more films in theaters, so especially anime films, so yeah. There you go.
It was nice seeing it in a theater that had, like, recliner seats. Like, it was not very good for the headache I had at the moment, but they were very nice seats.
But other than that, yeah, that's it for me.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Do you know if anyone's picked this up for home video licensing yet? I don't think so.
I want to say... Yeah, Funimation. They're teaming up with Shout Factory to bring it over.
Oh, good. Yay.
Yeah, like, interesting enough, the one Japan Society brought over was the one from Manga UK.
Oh, yeah, that's what my showing had as well. They showed the Manga UK logo, along with the Shout logo and the MAPPA logo.
But yeah, I'm gonna assume that's gonna change. I wonder if it was Funimation that had theirs at Otakon.
Yeah, I don't know, since obviously I didn't go. Yeah. If any of you guys did go to Otakon and saw the dub screening specifically, let us know if they showed the Funimation logo in front of it so we can figure this out.
Or just let us know what you thought of the film in general.
That too. We definitely like talking about these films, as you guys can tell. So if you start talking in the comments section or tweet at us what you thought about this movie, you will probably get a response out of both of us.
Yeah.
Not like an angry response either, like a, that's interesting response.
They should actually know where we are on Twitter, shouldn't they?
Yeah, they should. Let's see. Well, you can find all of our reviews, this podcast updates, all that, at the OASG on Twitter. I can also be found at Wandering Dreamer. I also help run another podcast called Manga in Your Ears, which has a Twitter account that's at Manga in Your Ears. I am trying to revive my personal blog, Narrative Investigation, so we'll see how long that lasts. And so I'm very busy on the internet.
Please, please revive it. Please revive it.
Well, I've got my second post out for the first time in a while today. I talked about the summer shows. And I finished up my thoughts on the spring shows last week, and I've got a couple essays coming out on Adam the Beginning and The Eccentric Family 2.
Okay.
Well, my Eccentric Family 2 review is basically, why did this happen?
What a preview! What a preview!
I did go to the PA Works panel at Otakon, and it sounds like as soon as that third book comes out, they're going to try and adapt it. Sounds like that is definitely their internal plans.
Okay. Oh, well, breaking news!
Breaking news, PA Works really likes this novel series.
Well, you can find me, Justin, at Kami_Nomi. I did some interviews at Otakon with Stephanie Shea. We talked about Gundam, Stella Chu. We talked about cosplay. And you're going to get by the time this podcast is up, you should get an interview with Toshio Furukawa and Shino Kakinuma up on the site as well, where we get into voice acting. So, yeah, a bunch of different stuff I did at Otakon. Go listen,
yeah,
go
read
it.
Yeah, I went to their panel, and I did not know they were married until I was in the panel, and I looked it up. I was like, oops, they're married. That explains this.
Yeah. So yeah, go check those out when they're up on theosg.com, the website of anime and manga and light novel articles. Yay!
Have we ever reviewed a visual novel on the website?
What's that?
Have we ever reviewed a visual novel on the website?
We are not reviewing visual novels on the website.
Okay, we should expand.
We should probably end this podcast before you suggest other stuff like this.
But you like my suggestions usually.
Guys, we'll see you later. We're done.
Bye.
Bye.